Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I have Piers Linney. Piers is best known as an investor on the BBC show The Dragon's Den, in which budding entrepreneurs get 3 minutes to pitch their business ideas to five investors. He has also featured on Channel 4's The Secret Millionaire. But beyond the media, Piers has had 25 years across a variety of sectors, be it law, entrepreneurship, venture capital, investment banking, innovation, or technology. He's been a non-executive director at the British Business Bank and is currently advisor to Sky on their Diversity Advisory Council. Chair of Atherton Bites, whose bikes took both first and second place in the 2023 World Championships, and he is the co-founder and executive chair of Implement AI. In today's episode, we talk about exiting his first business, a paper round, how there weren't many business role models in Manchester, so he was told to be an accountant. How he went from hustling businesses and delivering newspapers to getting into law, then banking, and then finally into tech. Why DEI is about both being asked to the party, but more importantly, about being invited to dance. How ambition is evenly distributed. How he got to a 45x exit on his Dragon portfolio. Why SMEs are asking, what is AI and is it going to kill us? And what Piers' thoughts are on whether it will or not. How and why nation states are obsessed with AI and why we should be too, and why he thinks that we all need equality of access to opportunity. Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit, or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have with me in the studio Piers Linney. Piers is best known as an investor on the BBC show The Dragon's Den. Piers, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
Really good to see you as well. Let us dive straight in. So most people this side of the pond certainly would know you from your time on Dragon's Den, which is the equivalent of Shark Tank here in the UK. But you joined the Dragons nearly two decades after starting your career in law, interestingly enough, with a focus on VC and PE, certainly long before venture became as well, I think, as it is known in the UK today. So can you talk me through that whole journey from law into entrepreneurship and some of the lessons that you learned, some of the failures that you kind of faced, as well as some of the successes that you had?
So you've got to go slightly further back in time in terms of my journey to understand why I ended up on TV, essentially.
Okay.
And also people often say to me, oh, you're on Dragon's Den, did you get the money? I get that a lot. Yeah. So I grew up in the north of England where the Industrial Revolution started, basically. Fascinated with all the entrepreneurs of the age. But no one really knew. I said, I wanted to go into business. No one knew what the hell I was talking about, really. So I had little businesses, like I had a paper round business. So I did wholesale papers, bought them and delivered them. And then at university, I was doing things as well. I was always kind of in business. But there weren't many people like me from that kind of background, that kind of school. I went to a pretty difficult school with its difficulties, shall we say.
Sure.
They ended up being a lawyer in the City of London, which is equivalent to Wall Street if you're in the US, and then ended up at what was then Credit Suisse First Boston, which became Credit Suisse when it was solvent. Mm. So I became a banker. So there weren't many people like me around, especially with Caribbean heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ended up on the list of the most influential Black Britons. And then through that, I ended up being sort of spotted by researchers, I guess, for TV opportunities. But I was always interested in business, but law, so everyone said to me, you want to be in business, become an accountant.
Yes, I know that. Right? I know that story very well. Yeah, yeah.
And this wasn't even my parents. They didn't have a clue, really. It was just people around me. I thought, okay. So I looked at accounting degrees. And then I did my A-levels twice, actually, because I didn't want to do maths. So I did law at night school. Yeah. And I love law. So I ended up doing law and accounting. But my passion really was always this process of starting businesses. And then so I became a lawyer. I was on that kind of conveyor belt. But all the time, though, I had these side hustles. I hate the phrase side hustles, right?
They're businesses.
Well, businesses, yeah. And one was, company formation and whatever they might be, doing parties, various things. You know, film finance with a very good friend of mine who's gone on to be a serious big wig in the film industry in the UK. Heads up to Brit Film, his new venture.
Yep.
And so even though I was a lawyer, I had these sort of things going on. I ended up at Credit Suisse in M&A. And then the internet boom came along, And I thought, you know, this is the time to go and get your wagon, hitch up a horse and head west. And I thought it was the only opportunity. And at the time, not most, I'm being generic, but a lot of the internet founders were either quite wealthy, or they had access to money, or they were consultants or investment bankers, people with a bit of cash. So I thought, well, I can afford to take 2 years out now, I've made a bit of money, and I can always go back. Mm. There's always a bridge back to the city or Wall Street. And of course, this was 2000. So that bridge was very quickly, in about March 2000, incinerated. Yeah. So there was no way back.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, okay, so you have to look forwards. And then from then on, really, this is like 2000. I've never worked for anybody else since, really. I've only really worked for the people probably for 3-4 years when I was in the city.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, talk to me about, you know, something you talked about several businesses there, right? So like film financing, you know, events, etc., right? Like, what were the biggest learnings for you from having done those? Like, what were the things you wished you'd done differently or that you could again?
You're getting a much longer podcast for that one.
That's fine.
But so I think one of the ones I like to use is my paper round.
Yeah. Right?
So I was about 13, 14 years old. I had a paper round. I was earning, what, £5 a week, right? So I was all them. And if you were late, it was like, got 50p knocked off. And I thought, there's got to be a better way. And then I don't quite remember how exactly it happened, but my dad, on Sundays, they didn't deliver newspapers. Mm-hmm. He had to get out of bed and go and deliver them. And where I grew up, when it snowed, you couldn't see a car, right? So my dad is like, he's not with us anymore. My dad said, look, can you go and get the paper? So I trot down on my BMX, get this paper, bring it back, give it to my dad. He's like, doesn't have to get out of bed. Making some toast, cup of tea, there's your newspaper. And he's like, fantastic, you know, he's like a tip. And I thought, well, hang on, so you know where this is going. So cut a long story short, I kind of spoke to all my neighbours and then flyered a broader sort of selection of the local community. Did you want your Sunday paper delivered? And he goes, yeah, brilliant, don't have to get out of bed. Mm. And I thought, well, hang on a minute, if I go and buy it from the newsagent, this is like, I'm 13-year-old, right? Yeah. I didn't use the word margin, but that's thinking. I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to make any money.
Yeah.
So then my dad said, you should go to the wholesaler. Mm. Then I couldn't do it, I was too young, but my dad rings up the wholesaler. Could he deliver papers for my son? How many? This many? Yeah, that's like a small news agent. So I got this paper delivered, bought them wholesale, delivered them, built the paper round through, you know, good service, word of mouth, the best form of marketing, as you know. And at Christmas, I'd go out and get all my tips. So I'm probably going from £5 a week for 6 days to £20. Mm. Harder work. You know, probably 4 hours work on a Sunday morning, and I'm probably in £20, and then I get £200 at Christmas in tips.
Yeah.
And then, so this is my first business I kind of built, and I learned, going back to your question, about finding a problem, solving it, dealing with customers, like the public, which can be quite difficult. Some people struggle with that. Building the relationship, service, dealing with issues, you know, the customer's always right, all that good stuff, and then building it. And then when I was sort of 15, 16, it wasn't cool to have a paper round. So I actually sold it. It was my first exit.
Oh, wow. Okay.
About £200, I think. I mean, that's a number.
I mean, so...
So you can see there, all those fundamentals.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, essentially, and I talk about it when I used to work at McDonald's. Obviously, I didn't own McDonald's, but a lot of that is really about how to deal with customers, right? Yeah. Like, it's so much of business is purely about, okay, what is the problem that the customer has? How are you solving it? And how do you keep them happy, right? And then how do you deal with them?
Sales.
Yeah.
So after that, when it became, I couldn't do a paper round really, I want to make more money, I ended up delivering like door-to-door sales. It was called Betterware. I don't think it's around anymore. We've got Amazon now. But and you deliver a pamphlet. It'd be full of like, you know, a rubber thing to get jar lids off and can openers and all this, pots and pans and stuff. A lot of plastic, basically. And I'd go back a week later and say, anything you like, they'd fill out the order list and I'd take it, I'd order it from the distributor, they'd deliver it, and I'd go and deliver it the next week. It's like a 3-week cycle. But you learn there about knocking on doors, dealing with people. Say, well, I ordered that and you got this. So I learned how to sell face to face. And most people, especially in their young businesses, they forget that revenue solves a lot of problems.
You know what I mean? Source of finances, I keep saying.
And just having that, having cash flow just gives you options. When you haven't got it, you don't have many options. So selling is one of the few professions. It's actually quite hard to get a qualification in.
Yeah.
But it's a profession, not just a skill. It's something you can learn. If you're not good at it, you've got to find somebody that is. Otherwise, you are destined to fail.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I talk a lot about, I mean, you talked about the difficulty, you know, the school that you went to, kind of the lack of kind of role models. And
I had my parents, they were my role models.
Yeah, which is amazing. I mean, and what did they do out of interest?
My mum was a Windrush generation. Windrush is one of the first boats that came over from the Caribbean. She wasn't on that boat, which came over in 63. To be a nurse in the NHS, you know, quite a common story. And my dad grew up in Manchester, working class lad, very bright. You know, he spoke like 6-7 languages.
Oh, wow.
Got to Cambridge, but in those days you kind of got there and you kind of came home again. You get to join the club.
Yeah.
And he worked as a... sort of export manager in quite a lot of ceramics business.
Yeah.
So he was like an executive, really. I grew up in a nice house. I had all mum had a BMW. It wasn't like, you know, rags to riches or anything like that. But the area in which I grew up with was quite difficult. And I was like the only kind of black guy in the village, quite literally.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting. I became quite good at judo.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, am I allowed to say bloody migrants coming over here actually doing work and paying taxes? Like, is that essentially that?
My mum was one of those people, actually, that, you know, it wasn't for people like my mum, they wouldn't have an NHS in the UK.
Well, I mean, this is the debate. I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit later on with one of my one of the questions I have for you. But yeah, I mean, and you do a lot of work, I think, within the kind of DEI sort of space as well.
I advise Sky, which is, if you American, a Comcast subsidiary on a DE&I.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so important at the moment. And you look at kind of some of the rubbish that's going on in the States at the moment, you know, the Sat, we're recording this sort of the week after the attempted assassination of one of the presidential candidates. And you're seeing a lot of rhetoric out there around, how the Secret Service failure was because of a DEI initiative, right? Because the leader of the Secret Service, for that event was female or whatever. I mean, it's become actually quite a toxic. It's become quite a toxic. I mean, like, I think generally it's become a bit of a toxic topic. And
the problem is DEI is toxic if you're not a minority.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you are, you know, I've got so many stories I can tell you, right? I mean, you know, even now people say, oh, you're on Dragon's Den, Shark Tank, did you get the money?
Yeah.
You know, I've had public companies where I've gone to events and, you know, everyone's there in the black tie and I'm wandering around going, hello, I'm Peter Sunny from so-and-so. And they're like, oh, brilliant. I have two champagnes, a gin and tonic.
Yeah.
Right? So I've gone for my life and one of my things why I champion diversity and inclusion. So diversity is being asked to the party, mm-hmm. which is great. You get through the door. They've got a mechanism to invite those people in from different backgrounds and ethnicities and sexualities, you know, neurodiverse, whatever it might be, disability. But inclusion's been asked to dance, right? It's being included. You feel as though you belong and you're going to stay there for a period of time. And what I try and do is try and make the journey for other people not as complicated or as difficult as mine was. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I always talk about it as, you know, we get lost in this sort of question of should you have quotas and all this sort of stuff. It's not even about that. It's about how do you create the feel whereby everyone has the opportunity or comes from the same base level.
Connecting. Yeah. So I always say ambition is evenly distributed. It's actually not. So I was on the board of the UK Government Bank during COVID. So we did the COVID loan support scheme, some 90 billion of facilitated finance. And we did some research at the time about access to finance from ethnic minorities. And it actually, if you're an ethnic minority, you're probably more likely actually to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah, so, 62% in the UK and US, I think.
So ambition is evenly distributed, or not as the case maybe.
Yeah.
But access to opportunity, to that social capital you need, to support and guidance isn't. And that's what we need to solve as connecting. And if you don't, if you're not rinsing all the ambition and capability out of your citizens in your nation, then you're missing a trick.
Yeah. I mean, look, again, this could be an entire podcast, and maybe we should do one specifically on that, because you clearly have had, you know, a ton of experience in that field. But I wanted to move on, because it would be remiss of me not to talk about Dragon's Den. As someone who has operated in the venture ecosystem for some time, it's always struck me that there is a clear disconnect in some instances, certainly not all, between how the Dragons writ large would value a business versus the broader market. From your perspective, how much of the Den was about entertainment and how much was actually about kind of the business of angel investing? And what advice would you give to budding entrepreneurs who are now considering going on? In fact, I have one of my own portfolio companies with my very, very small kind of angel checks and the small number of companies I have invested in, thinking about it at the moment. And were there any standout success stories, I guess, from your time on the show?
Okay, let's unpack it. So Dragon's Den is It's changed, actually. So I think when I joined, it was probably, this is like 2014, 15. Although, because of COVID, they replayed them all again.
Mm.
So it kind of went from...
It recycled.
Do you work in that bank on the high street? I know you're from somewhere. To, oh, right, it's Piers Linney. So, so the first thing is these people come out, you know, you don't know anything about them, and they pitched you, and that could take up to like an hour and a half, right? You know, when you see 12 minutes.
Yep.
I think, you know, you've got five people, got a question each, the pitch. You know, if you're interested, you've got to ask a lot of questions. That's real. The issue is that, as we both know, 99.8% of running a business is actually quite tedious and boring and hard work. You sort of cry. It's like, you know, it was Elon Musk said, it's like chewing glass. But that one moment where you've got a dream, an idea, an ambition, and you put it on a table, and five strangers look at it and go, nah, I don't know, or yes. That's interesting. That's televisual,
yeah.
Right? The rest of it isn't. You'd have to follow someone with a camera for 10 years.
Yeah, you'd actually have to, to really, you'd have to look at their story in depth. Yeah,
and most of them probably wouldn't make it. Yeah, so it doesn't really work for TV. So that was the first thing. And then, so what was interesting is that the producers often might say to you, well, the only tip you get would be maybe, this one's probably business lessons.
Mm.
Or we think this one's investable.
Mm.
It was always the opposite.
Really they interesting.
They didn't have a clue.
Yeah.
So my Dragon's Den experience was... a bit like a microcosm of a typical VC portfolio.
Yeah.
So I did 9 handshakes.
Yeah.
Right. 6 happened.
Yeah.
You do something called due diligence.
Yeah.
And you do have accountants and you do have lawyers.
Yeah.
Sometimes either they're there for the PR or they've got a better offer or it just told you that a poor
Or you go through the diligence and something's fallen.
It's just not quite what they said it was.
Yeah.
The 6 happened. One didn't work out and lost about $50,000, I think it was.
Mm.
So that's 6-1. So 4, I kind of got to the point often in small businesses where it becomes a lifestyle business.
Yeah, steady state.
It's never going to be an exit.
Yeah.
And the founders, you look at each other and think, well, what are we doing? And they go, I'll give you your money back. And you go, okay, and then that was the end of that.
Mm.
No return, really. Then I had one, and going back to one of your questions, is the valuation. So I had one, I was the first probably to do proper tech.
Mm.
So these... I can remember, I don't think they're all PhDs, 4 Israeli guys, like PhDs, making beautiful personalised children's books.
Okay.
And by personalised, I don't mean that they've stuck the name in it somewhere. I mean, it zooms in from outer space to a picture of your house.
Oh, amazing.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's evolved since then as well.
Yeah.
So they walk in with a term sheet from a venture capital firm I know.
Okay.
A small one, but it was bigger now.
Yeah.
But then it was quite a small one, but you know, credible. And I thought, well, hang on.
You can name them, by the way.
Someone's done some due diligence. These guys know what they're talking about. They've got a product. They've got sales. What's there not to like?
Yeah.
So I said, okay, I'll it's £100,000 for 5%.
Mm.
They wanted 4, but I had to negotiate because you're on TV. So I got up to 5% with some option structure. And I remember in the green room, all the other dragons, not all of them, but most of them are kind of like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
It's about a £2 million valuation.
Yeah.
That's not what this is about. That deal's never going to happen.
Yeah.
You've asked for some options. You've got to do the deal in the den. I was like, yeah, whatever. And I was like thinking, hang on a minute, I don't really care about the percentages. It's potential, how many X times return. What could this be worth?
Yeah.
That's what matters. Anyway, so the guys built the business, raised some money. I think Google put some money in even, Google Ventures. Had a tough time. They were kind of growing too quickly, burning too much cash, had to reset and kind of go again. So they went through all that. And the number's not public, but they sold it to a very large private equity fund.
Okay.
And they've kind of gone again.
Yeah.
And they made millions of pounds. And I got a 45X.
That's not bad.
Yeah. So you can probably reverse engineer that. But, you know, so I did quite well out of Dragon's Den. But it is like a VC portfolio.
Yeah.
So some fail. A lot become, you know... Not very nice. It's called the living dead. You can't get...
Yeah, zombies.
They won't grow. They won't zombies. They won't grow. They won't die. And then you get one that returns the fund.
Yeah. So the thing that strikes me there, and I'm like, I don't want to talk ill of the other dragons by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, I've met Duncan in the past.
I know Duncan quite well, actually.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but it strikes me that they are what most people would consider a traditional angel to be. Like, so I look at angel investing, there are kind of two types of angel investor in today's market. That's probably in itself, you know, quite not exactly how the market works. But if you kind of split angel investment into those that invest in tech for substantial potential exits down the track, so the 100Xs or whatever it is, or the 45X or whatever it might be, versus, you know, those that are the more traditional kind of investors. And it typically is, you know, lawyers, bankers, accountants who are throwing a bit of money behind a restaurant or a gym like their mate's gym.
Or something they understand. Or thing
yeah,
they,
precisely, yeah. right? Something they understand or that isn't necessarily aiming for that immense exit, right? And when I used to watch Dragon's Den, I that's the sort of feel it. That's the vibe that I would get in terms of kind of the investments that would make sense. Because to your point, right, most of those dragons would not have done, presumably, $100K check for 5%. Like they'd have looked at the like, and presumably, you know, the business might have been
$100K
revenue. Yeah. So you know, you see, and you see, you know, when they talk about the valuations, it's like, well, you're only doing, you know, 200,000 revenue, your business is worth 800 grand, right? Which we know in the venture world just wouldn't work, right? Because your founders would just be diluted down to nothing. So did that therefore mean that typically the businesses that came on the Den were kind of more of that traditional scope, or were looking for the publicity, or were, like what was the dynamic?
I don't know how you define traditional. Because most companies now have some tech in them.
Yeah, sure.
So you start this, when I was on there, you start to see apps.
Yeah.
Everybody had an app, right? Although when he said, you know, I always say, well, what's the business? Oh, I don't know, but I've got an app. So it was all the apps. That was kind
of... There's tech, so it'll work.
That period, yeah. So I think... I approached it more as I've always approached businesses with. So I've always invested in kind of... So you're investing in the people at that stage, aren't you? So you've got that continuum of... I've got an idea, so investing in the people, really, to a utility company where the whole management team could disappear in some horrible plane crash. It wouldn't matter, right? So that's that spectrum. So I always looked at that. And the valuations, I think, now... So a lot of mine were probably 10 to 30% of the company, depending on what it was and what stage they're at. Mm. Lowest was 5 million. So my 2 million valuation was the lowest valuation on the program until about 2 years ago,
okay,
when some crypto thing turned up. Right, who knows where that's ended up. Just before the crash, I think.
Yeah.
So I kind of like to think that sort of changed the game slightly. And the other thing about Dragon's Den, as you mentioned, is that when I started, it was factual,
yeah,
the BBC, right? And it moved to entertainment BBC.
Yeah.
So now you're seeing, you know, lots of different kinds of people on there and celebrities. And so I think it's something else needs to be done that captures that moment, but doesn't breach their IP.
Yeah. I it's interesting, actually, I think, that you say that, because I used to watch it. I mean, I lived overseas for like a decade or so, so I'd kind of catch up, or when I came to the UK, I might switch it on or whatever. And I used to find it back in, and it would have been in those sort of early 2010s, I used to find it quite engaging and interesting. And from a business perspective, okay, yeah, like some of the questions, you're like, okay, these are interesting questions to be asked, you know, of this business. And of course, coming from a business background myself, like that's the stuff that actually interests me and excite might be a bit of a strong word, right? But then I slowly but surely started getting kind of more switched off, generally just because, A, they weren't the sort of businesses that I was necessarily interested in, right? But secondly, to your point, you're looking at stuff and you're like, but this is, I mean, how did this company get selected to come on here? And it was clearly more because, okay, the product or whatever the service is or whatever it was, whatever it might have been, was interesting. It was like it was entertainment, right? But the business probably wasn't.
Or there's some, you know, backstory, some difficulty being overcome that they want to play. So the thing was, is that in the actual Den, okay, it's real. So a person comes out.
You are pitching.
They pitch you and you answer the question and they film it all. You never really stop. It's like 7-8 different cameras and it's filmed, right? Then that you're done. Right?
Yeah.
So then the TV, it's like that film Folding Doors. It's like there's like alternate universes. So the producer take it away and go, right, how do we make that into a TV program?
Got it.
So it might be that Piers hasn't invested because, you know, Terry started crying and he doesn't like the brand.
Mm.
I may have said that once and they've edited it. Mm. The reality is I didn't invest in your company because it's a subsidiary of some Canadian company and it's a franchise and you don't own any of the IP. Mm. Why the hell would I invest in that?
It's hilarious that you say
that. That's just too boring.
It's hilarious you say that. I won't again mention the name, but they have actually been on the podcast. Someone I know who went on the Den, and the issue that the Dragons had was when they dug into it, there was like an 80% foreign shareholder on the cap table, and they were like, "Well, why aren't they in the room?" Well, I don't know, but they're silent. They don't have. Well, no, they clearly have control.
They won't be that silent.
They own, yeah, exactly. They own 80%. And that was a lesson for that founder. Was like, okay, the optics matter, and actually, your
captain or you weren't EAS eligible,
yeah, yeah,
which is technical thing in the UK.
Yeah,
but it's a tax break, so if you can't get that,
was that something off. That's interesting? Was that something that the Dragons would think about?
No, I don't think it was a driving force.
Yeah.
But it was definitely there.
It was a nice
because
that.
You know, if you're in the UK, I don't, it's changed now, but then it was if you get SEIS,
yeah,
you get half your money back off the government, assuming you paid enough tax.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. Wouldn't we all love to get half of our money back off the government? And I guess the final question on the Dragons Den, I guess, is like, how much did you guys act in concert? I mean, it seems from the show that predominantly, you know, once one or two Dragons fell or declined deal, like often others would follow. But equally, like some of the moments on the show were where one Dragon goes against the kind of general trend of the other.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, so you know, you're making a TV program, right? So you know, you want to play up to camera a little bit, but you want to keep it real. But the competition for something interesting is real.
Really?
Because, you know, I'm going to invest in £500,000 or something in this series. And you want to invest it in the ones that got the most likelihood of getting some of it back.
Yeah.
So when it's interesting and they're there.
Everyone wants to. Yeah. So all the Dragons were essentially, they were putting money
down. They're fighting your own corner, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess from the Dragons' perspective, they weren't just there to be on the telly. Well, I mean, obviously, there was a part of that.
I mean, yeah. I got asked, I did a program called The Secret Millionaire.
Yeah.
If you know that one.
Yeah.
Which is a bit like Undercover Boss in a way, where you sort of go into a community, no one knows who you are, and you come out and start writing checks for charities, basically. And I got spotted because of that. So I kind of knew that I wasn't sure about doing Dragons Den. And there's a little story there. So I was away with Sir Richard Branson, just to drop a name, in his private game reserve, Ulusaba, in the Kruger National Park.
Yeah.
And I was being chased by the Dragon's Den producer, saying, are you going to do it or not? We need to know. And I was like, I don't know. Business, media, how do you mix the two together? Who should I talk to? So obvious answer, Sir Richard and I have a chat over a Corona. And he goes, yeah, you should do it. There's no one like you on TV. You'd be good at it, blah, 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 blah. Screw it, just do it.
Can I just say Corona does not sound like a Mancunian beer that you should be drinking?
I do like Coronas. I also like it because the guy, when he passed away, he gave everyone in his village $1 million.
Oh, really?
That's a great story.
That's an amazing story. Yeah.
He's a billionaire. So Richard says, you know, screw it, just do it, go and do it. And I said, okay, great, thank you. He picked up my beer and walked off. And he said, come back here, bring the producers back and tell them you're in. That's where I ended up on Dragon's Den. So I ended up there really because I was surprised to be asked, to be quite frank. And then there was no one really like me on TV. So I was kind of doing it really to just to be a role model, but also I knew it was an opportunity. But I've always been really B2B. So you couldn't look at me and go, oh, he's got that company up on the high street. I'll go and buy it.
Yeah, there's not
sells.
That consumer no. kind of, which
unless
Peter you, Jones, I think.
Unless
had
you watch
quite
the TV,
of.
You think, what I need is some cloud infrastructure. Yeah. So it didn't really help me in that respect, really.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wouldn't be sat here with you if I hadn't been on Dragon's Den. So it's opened doors and I wouldn't have been aboard a British business bank, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I've got this sort of
profile.
We'll
talk about that as well. Yeah. No, look, and I mean, this. Any of us that kind of do things that put us out there, it isn't about the being put out there. It is about the doors that it opens, the relationships
you
build and what you can do with it, right? Which I think is massively important. To your point, like you wouldn't be sitting here. I wouldn't be sitting with you. A, had you not been on Dragons Den, but B, had we not had, you know, Alok in common, right? Who's your co-founder at Implement
AI. Is that how you say his name?
I mean, I don't know if that's how he says his name. That's how I'd say
right,
his name.
Okay.
It's either Alok or Alok, depending on how Indian you want to get about yeah. it, I guess. Right. So look, let's move on from the Den, because again, I think that was actually quite a small portion of your life, but obviously with some outsized impact. Right. But you know, you've moved on quite, I mean, it's over a decade since you're on the,
yeah,
on
so
the
just
program.
On that. So I've got Only mentor I've ever really had, I won't say he's a formal mentor, is a chap called Sir Ken Alissa.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Lord Lieutenant of Greater London, looks after the royal family when they're out in London.
Amazing.
And he said to me after Dragon's Den, he said, right, you've got two options here. You can go down the celebrity route and go to the opening of a fridge and an envelope, or you can be more serious. So I went down the kind of serious route. So I became trustee of Nesta, the UK's largest innovation foundation, 600 million, on the board for 6 years. Then I was on the board of the government bank for 4 years during COVID.
Mm.
So this kind of, you know, stuff that I think was meaningful.
Mm.
So it's been a longer arc, But eventually,
more
I think it's come good because I don't feel as though I'm defined by Dragon's Den.
Yeah,
it's just something that was part of my history.
Yeah, it is a node in the journey of Piers Linney, right? So, I mean, look. So moving on, talking about implement AI, you and I have previously spoken about why it's very much of the moment, right? Like we did a presentation to a room full of people talking about kind of how SMEs could start thinking about this, right? And this was, I think, a year ago now, and it was, you know, it was just as people were starting to figure out where AI sort of fit into their lives, if at all, right? But unlike most tech businesses that are trying to build completely new AI products, right? Implement is about helping SMEs integrate AI into their businesses. So what is your take on what SMEs should be doing today? And what is the risk from your perspective of them sitting on their hands?
Yeah, there's a clue in the name. We thought long and hard about the branding and called it Implement AI.
Mm.
So essentially, so Alok and I met probably 4 or 5 years ago. Actually, I did a podcast for a big UK bank called NatWest, and he was one of my guests. And we kept chatting now and then, and you know, about business. And we bumped into each other randomly, and like when he was in the country, because he lives in Portugal, in Lisbon,
and he's a dentist.
And he's a dentist. So he was looking at machine learning to work out how to sort of fit things into your mouth essentially and understand what's going on in your mouth. And then we got talking, and then he had a business looking at sort of kind of AI training.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of said, well, you know, this is bigger than the internet, right? So I'm looking at getting into this in a big way.
Yeah.
Well, it's the last platform in terms of human involvement, I think. And we got talking, and we said, let's just get on with it. So we started Implement AI about 18 months ago. And 6 months was kind of like, we knew the why. We didn't know the how or the what. So we started talking to people. This is the best way to start businesses often. Talking to people who came to us and said, what's AI and is it going to kill us? So you'd have these conversations about what it is and what it's capable of. And they say, that's really interesting, actually. Can you show us? So now we're into pilots and MVPs. So you do the pilot MVP. Look, it can do this and there's your ROI. And they go, that's really good. We want it. You go, oh, okay. So now you're into developing an industrialized solution that can be deployed by businesses and sort of mission critical stuff. And like, okay, then you start deploying them. But we're still doing quite a few different things. So Alok, to be fair to him, doing quite a lot of work on what's the why. We've got to know the why, what's the how and the what. And where we've kind of come out is that organizations have human resource, right? It's one of the biggest costs, right? And you know that it can be quite hard in many, many sectors that as your revenue grows, it's like a linear relationship, essentially. And if you can break that, or at least, you know, augment.
Which is what most software tries to do, right?
Exactly. Like, scale. But SaaS, though, is still very much, there's a human and cognitive labor pulling levers and pressing buttons and putting stuff in and, you know, all this kind of API and Zapier and make, it kind of works, but it's still often a human just making this thing work. And we looked at it and thought, right, actually, what you can do is augment humans with AIs. So an AI today, and by AI, I mean, it's still a tool, right? It's like a toaster. It's not AGI. It's not going to, it's not recursive.
It's not self-reflective.
We're not there yet, right? Yeah. It's a tool. It's software. So it's very good, though, at replicating and displacing knowledge work and cognitive labor. Very, very good at it.
Yeah, very scared. Yeah,
it is very good at it. And it's only going to get better.
Yeah.
So the first thing is, don't build your business about AI today. Think about AI is going to be in 12, 24, 36 months, essentially, and start there. So we thought, right, we can deploy AI agents that work with humans. So a job, can't do a job yet. A job has goals, and to achieve the goals, you have tasks. Now, a lot of those tasks are repetitive, they're mundane, people don't want to do it. So I think that the attracting talent in the future, part of the secret is going to be you've automated all the stuff they don't want to do. So they get to do more meaningful work. So you're augmenting humans to be better, more productive, more efficient. So that means you need fewer of them, which is a whole different podcast about where that's going.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, then we get into UBI and how do people maintain those? So, yeah.
There's an arc of opportunity. There's a complexity to what we're all going to be doing. Because, you know, people said knowledge workers, you know, it's going to be admin assistants and low-level jobs, if we can call it that. Actually, it's not. If you're walking around an office earning $500,000 or pounds a year, you've got enormous balls on your back, okay? Because taking you out adds a lot of value to the bottom line.
But just on that, right, and I go back and forth on this, because you hear a lot about, okay, accountants and lawyers are going to get replaced, as an example, right? But the way I think about it is, like, you know, an AI agent can learn from a corpus of material. But so much of what a lawyer, as you know, and what an accountant or, you know, someone in finance does, it isn't actually necessarily rules-based. It is intuition and gut-based, right? Yeah. Like a lot of what you do as either a lawyer or, like, you know, in finance, as an example, one of the businesses I worked with, I looked at their revenue. I was like, hold on a second. You guys are, you know, treating all of this as agency. Well, actually, you're the principal in this transaction. So your revenue, actually, your the revenue that you can report is 5x what you have been reporting. And that actually set them on a, you know, a really strong trajectory, because now they were showing much larger revenues than they previously had. And all that took was me calling up the auditor and saying, look, this is what I'm going to argue. Are you agreed with it? And they were like, yeah, that's fine. That only comes from knowledge. The problem I see, and to your point, right, you're augmenting humans. Problem I see, or the potential problem I see, is in these industries, maybe I don't know much about where law is tracking, but the accountancy profession, as an example, is seeing fewer and fewer people entering the profession year on year because it is just considered not particularly interesting, not particularly sexy. So there isn't actually this sort of on-ramp for incoming people to build that knowledge and experience, such that at the other end, and maybe by the time they would have got there, the AI is so good that actually it wouldn't make a difference. But I don't quite see that, because you always want a human in that decision-making process. There are just going to be fewer people able to make those really core, strong decisions, because they won't have come through that experience ramp, right? So yes, I agree that there is a target on the back of people like me, but to some extent, I think that target is a little bit smaller than it's being made up.
Right. So you fall into one trap, which you kind of nearly avoided at the end, is you're thinking of AI today.
Yeah, no, I get it. Yeah.
All right, so that's one thing. It will evolve. What you did say, which I completely agree with, is that, and the way I think of it is a pyramid. Mm. So there's a pyramid of labor, right? And it's a lot of it's been human. It was physical labor, engine, machines, you know, electricity, all that stuff. And then it's cognitive labor. So we value cognitive labor highly, right? Accountants, lawyers, hedge fund managers, right? And the point is that pyramid of knowledge work, labor, is being replaced or filled with technology.
Yeah,
which is fine.
From the transaction.
Going back to your example, the analysis that you did to enable you to see that insight and come to that conclusion and have that conversation with that client based on what you know about their goals and aspirations, that analysis you probably did yourself, whereas in the future you won't have to do that.
Yep.
So we have to migrate to the top of this pyramid. Now that triangle top's getting smaller, but we have to migrate to the top in terms of add that value.
Mm.
So adding more EQ, not IQ.
Yeah.
Because the value of IQ and the cost of IQ is going to zero.
Mm. This is interesting. I'm going to be recording a podcast with the PhDs, built a couple of AI businesses in the past. I'm going to butcher this, right? You know, he says, intelligence is knowing that tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is knowing not to put it in a fruit salad, right? So you know, we're at the intelligence layer at the moment. It knows what stuff is. Once we get to that wisdom layer, where it's actually able to you know, essentially have that conversation, whether it's with itself or someone else,
that will come. All that stuff. So going back to, so you've got we have two types of agent, really. So one is interactive, humans in the loop, helping you do stuff, talking to customers, interactive humans, right? But then you've got the ones that are in the background. So these are what we call embedded agents. So these are doing things that humans can't do. Mm. So things like...
Or faster than humans can do.
Faster than humans. And Alot has this great couple of slides I always use, where it's like you've got a dark room, there's a few little glimpses of light you can see, and suddenly you turn on your spectral vision or night vision, or your infrared, and suddenly you can see people, shapes, all sorts of stuff going on.
Mm.
And that's what it allows you to do, is to see things and find the unknown unknowns. And if you can see things that other people can't, you can react to them in terms of how you engage with customers, how you develop your product or your service. And that's a competitive advantage.
Yeah.
So these are doing things like, you know, we do a lot of voice stuff, so call recording here. You've got companies that have people that are paid to listen to phone calls and make notes, right? That could be fully automated. I mean,
more that,
the concept of humans answering phones in call centers, I did a post on LinkedIn saying call centers will be going away by 2026. And it went viral. and had a guy, he's like a call center YouTuber who knew they existed. And he's like, I'm going to call this AI. I'm going to call this AI right now live. Let's go. And I was thinking, oh no, where's this going to go? I was watching. Yeah. And he has this conversation with his AI. And you can see at the end of it, it was like
a
serious case of cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
And you can see him at the end of it. And to be fair to him, he sort of went, that was pretty good.
Yeah.
And you can see the blood draining out of his face. Because, you know, in complex requirements, you know, to sell something of high value or it's a really complicated issue, you could need a human for the time being.
Not necessarily. So I was at a supper club, sat next to a founder. She's built essentially a chatbot that will negotiate a discount online, right? So usual story is...
I know, but you're not going to buy a custom built...
Oh, you're not going to buy a lot,
Or Lamborghini Urus with an agent, right? That's what I mean. But 60, 70, 80% of those conversations, those interactions, will be completely automated. You don't need rates, lights, heating, desks, headsets, calls, people, holidays, sickness. It'll just be in the cloud.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely not an AI doomer. I think there is so much potential in it. And I think, you know, the fact that you guys are...
it's the most exciting thing.
Yeah.
I can't sleep at night sometimes.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking, oh, all right, we could do this now as well and do that. But the point that what we try and do though is make it real. Yeah. There's so much noise.
And for SMEs specifically, right? Who don't necessarily, you know, they're not sitting there with a ton of engineers in the office.
They haven't got an innovation budget.
Yeah.
So you turn up and say, do you want innovative AI? And I don't have a person to run it. I haven't got a project manager. I haven't really got a budget for that. So we have this like pyramid, right? We have optimize. So how do you do what you do better? Mm. Reduce cost basically. Mm. And then innovate. Mm. Innovate can be real innovation, like, you know, top left of the sort of risk, complexity, ROI. But also innovation can just be doing things that you've not been able to do before, like call people at weekends or take calls at weekends, because now an AI can do it, rather than you paying to have six people in office overnight.
Yeah, yeah. Or having to set up a call center in the Philippines or in India or wherever it is. Right?
And manage it.
Yeah, I mean, like, I mean, from my slightly narrow viewpoint within kind of the finance field, like very clearly the thing that I'm waiting for is like fully automated bookkeeping, right? And where you know, we've had, you know, OCR, so you've got machines that are able to read a document and part process it, right? But it's not fully processed. I think we will get fairly quickly to a place where
bookkeeping is, if you've got, as you said, if you've got the information, the payments, things coming in and out, it's rules based.
It's rules based.
It should be completely.
Yeah, yeah. As long as you set up those rules sort of initially, and even
it's not really intelligence.
Yeah, and it's rules based. It's rules based, but actually, again, like with accounting, there are often things where, okay, does it go in this bucket or that bucket, right? That is something that an agent.
That's where now could have a go based on, and then over time it could learn what you've done previously do that or flag it to you.
Yeah, well, precisely, right? I mean, the thing, and then to take it up that kind of pyramid as you mention it. I mean, you know, I've recorded, I don't know, 200 episodes of this podcast. I've written a bunch of newsletters. I've done, you know, a ton of talks, lots of stuff on LinkedIn, and all the rest of it, and then I have a team of CFOs right working with me. So I've got, you know, the husband of my COO who's a dev, you know, we sat down, we're like, okay, what could we do? You know, what would be a smart thing to do here? And the first obvious thing to do, and I know you've done this as well, right? You created a peers chatbot, right? I think was one of the first projects.
That was a long
time
ago.
Yeah, one of the first projects you did, right? With this whole kind of AI paradigm. But essentially you could train the AI on the content that is out there, right? That I've written, or even that others have written for that matter. And then the next step is, you know, we even internally with our CFOs, we ask and answer questions of each other, right? Okay, you know, what is the tax treatment of this if I'm exporting to France, for argument's sake, whatever, right? And there's always someone within the team who's done that or knows that. Yeah. And then you get the higher level questions as well, right? And you could get into this loop of just constantly updating,
feeding. If you're a founder as well, you know, you get asked the same question
again by
the team again, or HR. So. Yeah. All that, the idea of being able to...
You don't have an FAQ list anymore.
Communicate with a knowledge base, essentially. Yeah. Means that the idea of FAQs, it all kind of goes away. They'd be much cleverer than that.
Yeah, and I think this is... The killer feature, if you want to call it a feature, right, that brought AI mainstream, because let's face it, AI has been on and off you know, for 40 years, people have been dabbling in things that look like AI, or you would call AI today. I mean, we've had people that built systematic trading systems, you know, back in the 90s or early 2000s, which were essentially machine learning AI based. The killer feature essentially was the fact that you're able to talk to it, i.e., you know, via chat, which is what ChatGPT opened up. Now you've moved to voice, you know, so you're able to have a conversation.
It's gone beyond that now. So now the machines, we'll call it that, are gathering all of our senses.
Yep.
So they've got chat, they can hear, they can speak, they can listen, they can see now. Mm. So, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, you'd spend $1 million or pounds on teaching an AI what a can was.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's get a robot to say, pick up that can and go and put it on that chair over there. It needs to know what a can is, spatially where it is.
Yeah.
You know, that's physical. But it's got to know what a chair is.
Yeah.
And that you have to spend $1 million to teach what a chair was.
And whether it's appropriate to put it on a chair.
Exactly. Yeah. And all these different cans. And now, you know, if you've got ChatGPT or probably ChatGPT, take a picture of a room and then ask it, describe this scene. And it will describe it in the infinite detail. Mm. Like this room, it will describe what this table looks like it's made out of, if it's real wood or not real wood. Mm. So that's kind of gone away. So now you can put a generalist, we haven't talked about this, a generalist model into a robot or a humanoid-looking robot, and they're humanoid because it navigates our built environment, because that's built for us. And they can do almost anything in terms of understanding what to do and what not to do.
Yeah.
So you've got knowledge work, cognitive labor, but very soon, and it's coming very quickly, I think, it's going to be physical labor as well. I think my daughter's, 16? I think by the time she's my age, you won't get insurance to drive a car around the city. You won't get
insurance.
Well, she'll be a bit older though. And you won't get insurance to have a human on a building site. Yeah. It won't make any sense.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's two things I would say. So I have two daughters, one's 23, one's 16. I've said this time and time again on the podcast. Like, I've told them the world of work that my younger daughter will enter will look nothing like the world of work today. In fact, you know, she's currently about to do her equivalent of A level. She's doing IB diploma. She's like, I don't know what to do at university. I said, don't sweat it, because it won't make a difference, because things will have moved.
Well, my son, I've got a son, and he was, you know, learning to code. And he spent probably a year doing all these code courses, and he was doing really well with JavaScript, a bit of Python. And I'm like, if you learn to code, you'll never be out of work.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh yeah, I'm going to learn to code.
Yeah.
And then about a year ago, he's kind of like, I'm not sure about this coding because of AI.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, oh no, you should learn to code. It's good. Do Python, because that's quite helpful and that kind of. He's like, right. Now I'm saying to him, don't learn to code. It's a complete waste of time.
But you can just get Copilot to write it for you. So why?
And that's now. Imagine it in 3 years. So in the future, a couple of things people don't really understand is, it's like Star Trek. You will talk to technology and say, I want an application that does this. It will write the code. It will provide a UI. Mm. You'll try it and go, no, I don't like that. It needs to do this, this, and this. It'll go, okay. It'll just change the code until you iterate it and it does what you want.
Yeah.
So everybody will be able to create their own software as a service, hosting in the cloud.
I think this is where SMEs have that opportunity, because like one of the things that I think won't be disrupted fully, right? But like you look at these large, like, so let's take Salesforce as an example, right? Like massive CRM tool. Everyone in the world knows what it is. Everyone in the world knows what it does, and a lot of people use it. But the reality is that it's a tool that potentially for my business is 60% what I need, but 40% not what I need, right? I can potentially now just
all
create.
SaaS.
Yeah,
all SaaS.
Exactly. I can now create a bespoke product.
What is a successful SaaS, right? It's one where like a bell curve of market opportunity.
Mm.
And in the middle, their features and benefits essentially match the bell curve.
Yeah.
So if you're an outlier over here or here, it doesn't really work for you.
No,
so
it has to do the average.
As you move out, here's the 90% what you need. As you move out, you're 60 and you get to 10%. So then you start adding other SaaS to fill in the gaps. Whereas what you can do now, not quite, we're getting there now, even like things like Power Automate, automation platforms, no code, low code, is that you could be an outlier over here. I want to run my business in this differentiated way.
Mm.
I don't want to do it that way.
Mm.
And you can build that now.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's massively exciting. And again, entire podcast could be had on this. But I mean, let's move on, because this one, I'm quite interested in your take, having been following you on Twitter and various other platforms for quite some time. So you've been a fairly vocal critic of the previous government And you were, but you were a NED, right? At, as you mentioned, the British Business Bank between 2017, 2021 during COVID. And what do you hope to see from the new government specifically on tech, venture, angel? Because there's a lot of noise about what they're going to do with, let's say, carried interest on private equity, the EIS kind of rules change next year potentially, or I think due to EU state aid regulations would have to come to an end and need to be extended, etc. So where do you see the ecosystem heading? And even more specifically, you have said that ambition is evenly distributed, but access to financial capital, social capital, support, guidance, and the networks needed to succeed isn't. Your mission is to empower, educate, and inspire others to pursue their goals and dreams augmented by technology. So how can we, and more specifically, the government, get better at this and empower that?
Wow, you need like four different podcasts.
I do.
Trying. Yeah, so historically, I won't go into the history of the politics. I think it's just time for change, basically. So,
sure.
I mean, this is the one election where I was actually out in the streets
campaign.
Putting letters for your letterbox.
Interesting.
I've never done that before. I got letterbox knuckle. Yeah. He's like, I don't know who built these spring-loaded
letterboxes. So letterbox you went back to your newspaper days. I know,
now they've got these spring-loaded, they're like alligators. Yeah, putting it. Yeah. So I was actually delivering letters. So hopefully the time for change. But the point is that, so you use technology as the way to do this. So I think that you can augment yourself using artificial intelligence, technology generally, but AI especially, to be better at what you do, to have a sidekick, someone you can talk to, someone you can throw your ideas at, and it's insane. I do lots of keynotes, and I always ask the room, who uses Claude AI or ChatGPT or even Gemini themselves to augment yourself? And about 5% put the hand up, 5% in the room. I'm like, it's like being pushed into a cage fight, right, with this massive kickboxer, and you've never done it before in your life, and it's a fight to the death. And someone says, you can take Iron Man. And you go, nah, I don't know how it works. It's like that. What the hell are you doing? So that's the first thing. The second level is organizations across all sectors. Is you should be using this technology to sort of augment yourself, maximize revenue growth, minimize your costs, more margin, more wealth creation, basically. But then the next level is it's nation state.
Mm.
So the reason why nation states are obsessed with AI, why the US is restricting, you know, Chinese access to chips and technology is because if China solved AGI, which is, you know, recursively learning AI, on Monday, and we solved it on Wednesday, in an exponential world, we'd never catch up.
Yeah.
So that's why they're paranoid about it. So it really is winner takes all. So in our lifetime, hopefully, it'll solve nuclear fusion, right? So energy will become
abundant
and free, essentially. All these massive power stations will become redundant overnight. So there's huge gains to be had in terms of this technology. So the nation state level, what governments need to do is make sure, I'm talking about the UK now, is in this exponential world, I always use this picture of a ship leaving the harbour. And the ship is leaving the harbour, right? Mm-hmm. I spent 15 years of my life, probably 12 years, trying to sell cloud technology, unify comms in the cloud. And I do keynotes today about transitioning to the cloud. I use the same notes I used 10 years ago. It's the same keynote, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Just change the name to protect the innocent. And then AI is not going to be the same. You know, if you're not using this technology within 3 years, you're doomed because you won't be able to catch up.
And so, but what does that mean, therefore, for let's talk about the UK government, right, with their ambitions for house, you know, for building houses, for supercharging the economy? Obviously,
you've got to make sure that we're enabled, that this economy doesn't get left behind in this technological sort of evolution, which will be the last industrial revolution, essentially.
Mm.
So that's the first thing. And then you've got all the other stuff, which is like, that's not going to really help you build more houses. But it's a question of actually looking at a nation state and focusing on its citizens, not your career. That's, I think, the change we need to see. But I think in the new administration we've got now is that and then Keir Starmer says this, is that, you know, we're going to be focusing on what we can do for you, not what we can do for ourselves.
Mm. I mean, I think it's a super interesting question because, like, you know, with everything you said, there are essentially two potential outcomes, right? You have dystopia or utopia, right? Dystopian view would say, you know, the technology will essentially replace us and therefore what are we going to do with our lives? And the utopian view would be, no, the technology is going to augment us and give us more time. Like, and I think a lot of people don't get this, you know, you will absolutely understand this, right? A lot of people don't understand that what their salary and their pension and all of this sort of stuff is just a way of buying time. Like, that is the actual resource, right? And I think what the technology does, what AI is doing even today, is allowing you to have more time, right? Because it speeds up your ability to do other tasks or whatever it is. I mean, I use it, I don't know, for argument's sake, to summarize calls that I've had and send those out as...
It's like a time machine.
It's essentially giving you back the time that you would have otherwise lost, and therefore you can do other things with it, right? But I think if I think from a governmental perspective, right, you have a huge sway, and you, again, going back to your period, you do have a huge swathe of people, and we saw this during COVID as well, right? Like, the majority of people that were essential in the workforce were the people that were doing what would have been the most mundane but critical jobs, right? Yeah. Whether that is working in the NHS or, you know, but delivering stuff or, you know, or in the kitchens cooking or whatever it is, right? Which is not today being done by AI. And I kind of wonder how you ensure that you don't have, or you don't create essentially an underclass of people, you know, where you have sort of the AI driven overlords in terms of, you know, people who have been able to kind of capture the value from the value that flows from using that technology to those that can't. And equally, how do you get to, you know, as a government, how do you ensure that wealth is spread equally? And I'm very much sort of massive centrist. I'm not massively in favor of, well, I'm definitely not in favor of sort of pure socialism. I'm also not massively in favor of just pure libertarianism and everyone for themselves. So how do they strike that balance, I guess? I mean, like, what do they do?
So you touched on one big thing there, which is that I actually wrote a blog on this. It's on my website, piersandlee.com/blog, which is about the, I call it AI UK Navigating the Future, right?
Right.
So it's really about what you need to have is, I'll use the word, holistic plan, right? This holistic plan for everything. So we're in the UK, we're never going to own all the infrastructure. Right? Mm-hmm. It's not even hosted. It's all American or Chinese or whatever it might be. So we're playing across the top, really, of this technology. So you've got the hyperscale cloud providers. They're not here either. So we're playing across the top and using this technology, these platforms, to create value. But we as a nation and our sovereign wealth fund, which is probably a slightly different structure than the one they've announced, should be investing in the infrastructure.
Have they announced? Sorry, I must have missed that.
Yeah,
one.
The sovereign wealth fund, but it's more about sort of UK investment infrastructure.
Was this the GB Energy one?
No, that's a different one.
That's a different one. Okay, there's more.
The King's Speech, it's all there. But we need to make sure that we're investing.
Yeah.
A bit like Norway's doing.
Yeah.
That we're investing in these infrastructure plays to make sure that as they expand and grow and when value is created, which will no doubtly happen, is that we've got a stake in it that is distributed across the nation. So that's something that they need to make sure that actually happens. The other one's education.
Yep.
Is understanding technology, how to use it.
Which comes back to the kind of DEI conversation. Well, like, if everyone has that.
Well, one of the big issues you touched on there is increased wealth concentration.
Yeah.
So we all end up working for Mark Zuckerberg, you know, Elon Musk, all the usual suspects, you know, and then Bezos. So there's like three employers in the world, essentially, which... You might laugh at that, but
no,
actually,
Amazon is like the largest employer next to the UK.
As its wealth begins to concentrate, and as you get this exponential growth, and you probably find the competition commissions around the world have got a bit more work to do now. Mm. So that might stop it. But you're going to get concentration of wealth, and also not everybody can afford, you know, a high powered machine full of GPUs. So probably most of you have a phone for where you're going to see it. But the flip side of that is now you can give an iPad or whatever technology you want to use to let's use the example of a village in Africa, and give them the intelligence and access to the same data as, you know, Wall Street finest hedge fund manager, essentially, or knowledge worker, whatever it might be. So there's two sides to the coin. We've got to make sure that this technology, that A, we're playing in it, but B, that it also, going back to my quote, that it is distributed as equally as possible. Otherwise, you're going to have very much to have not. And as I said before...
Which was a massive problem during COVID again, right? Oh, yeah. Where you had a ton of people unable to access education because they didn't have a device
or Wi-Fi.
Or internet, right?
Yeah. People forget that. They assume everyone's got a nice laptop and Wi-Fi. It's not the case. But the point is here, this ship's leaving the harbour, and whether it's you individually, your organisation or nation state, once that gap between the quayside and that ship is larger, you can't make the leap, It's you're never coming back.
Yeah.
It's not digital transformation. Oh, I'll do it in 2 years or 3 years. Oh, I'm busy. I'm going to go holiday. It's not cloud. Oh, I'll do it next year. You've got to start thinking about it now.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, look, I have one final question, which is, what is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is the hill that you would die on defending?
I think it is equality of access to opportunity. So I don't know if it's contrarian, really, but for a lot of people, it's becoming contrarian, sadly. But it is about that quote you used in mine, which is that ambition is absolutely evenly distributed. Everybody should have the opportunity to maximize who they are and who they want to be. And, you know, whether it's the people around them, whether it's the state, whether it's you individually, I mean, we all forget, you know, you and I are sitting here, right? We have so much social capital. I always say, just take some of it, go and sprinkle it on some people and watch how it changes their lives. But we all forget that because we get lost in a little bubble. So it's trying to unlock all that social capital and kind of share it out a bit more. And I think you'll see that, forget AI exponential change, you'll see an exponential change in access to opportunity, people creating value, which we all benefit from.
Amazing. Piers, it's been an incredible pleasure having you on the podcast. Really, really glad you're able to join me. For the audience, where can they find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? I know you are.
So implementai.io is the Implement AI website. And then my website, lots of blogs on AI if you want to read them, is pierslinney.com.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been absolutely wonderful. Thanks for having me.